Yes, the business wants you to do it faster and for less.
Yeah, do it faster.
And with half as many people and a tenth the budget.
That's the only thing now. Okay, now I know the only truth in engineering. The only truth in engineering is that the business wants you to do it faster. It is kind of true.
100% agree on that. I'm sure there's a blog post in there.
Have you ever wondered how your dev team ranks in terms of productivity, speed, and business impact? With LinearB's new engineering benchmarks report, you can find out. The product of comprehensively analyzing the work of almost 2,000 dev teams at close to 1 million branches, the 2022 Engineering Benchmarks Report is the first ever look at what performance metrics make engineering orgs elite, average, or underperforming. Best of all, if you want your dev team's number to go from average to elite on any of the benchmarks, the report also provides concrete guidance on the behaviors, tools, and processes you need to get there. To explore the report in full, visit linearb.io/benchmarks or click the link in the show notes of this episode.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to Dev Interrupted. I'm your host, Dan Lines, and today I'm joined by Zach Goldberg, CTO at Dama. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, awesome to have you here. And for our listeners out there, I mean, first off, Zach is one of the smartest people I know, honestly. We get to catch up fairly often, okay? We're both in LA. You're a customer of LinearB. You're also a friend of mine. And we had lunch just the other week, which was a great time.
Yeah, I appreciate you picking up the tab on that.
And so, you know, that's the least I can do. We always have like awesome conversations, you know, they range. I mean, you have a background in entrepreneurship. Obviously you're a CTO, I think like many times now, CTO founder, CTO, you know, started some companies. So you got a wealth of knowledge. We usually talk like engineering related stuff, also things on careers and life. And one of the things that I know, you know, about you, and it comes up, you know, often enough, you have this thing around the pursuit of truth. And it's also like the kind of the way that you talk about these things. It seems like you have a philosophy on it. I think you've said a few times, there are a few truths in engineering leadership.
Yeah, absolutely.
You have a story about this. Can you take me through the journey that kind of allowed you to arrive at that conclusion?
Yeah. So it starts actually back in college for me. When I was an undergraduate, I applied to a dual degree program. You know, I was this young overachiever. I wanted to do both business and engineering. Applied to a program that was both, and unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, as it turned out, I wasn't accepted to the dual program, but I was accepted to the engineering portion. And so I matriculated and started college as only an engineer, and I still wanted to do business. I was dead set on that. And I was very fortunate. I was assigned an undergraduate advisor who was to, you know, help me go through and figure out how to college. We sat down for coffee. I looked him in the eyes. His name was Max. He said to me, or I said, you know, let's talk about how do I get into this dual degree program? And he looked me dead in the eyes, took a pen out of his pocket protector, because of course the professor had a pocket protector, took the napkin from under his coffee, drew an XY axis and drew a line on it, looked me dead in the eyes and said, tell me what you know about special relativity. And then for the rest of the 2 hours of that coffee, we didn't talk a word about business. And of course, you know, 19-year-old me knew nothing. I still know nothing about special relativity. But the journey that he took me on throughout my undergraduate career was one of focusing on the engineering discipline, right? He convinced me that I could spend my time, my 4 years as an undergraduate, half my foot in business school and half my time in engineering, where I could really focus on engineering and be the best engineer I could be. And that sort of focus and discipline and rigor really comes from him. Now, I do want to mention, his name was Max Mintz. He unfortunately passed away about a month ago. For everybody who knew Max, honor him. He's a phenomenal individual and a great friend throughout my student life and adult life. And so he is missed greatly. And I honor him by telling these stories and some of the lessons that he taught me. One of the other key lessons from Max was, you know, he saw himself not as a teacher of computer science or of engineering. And his mission was not to teach algorithms or quantum computation or differential equations. Max saw his mission as helping students and preparing students learn how to learn for the rest of their lives. Right? And so circling back to your question about a few truths in engineering, you know, what do we really know about this field of study? Like, what have we really learned? Well, let's start. How long have we been doing this? You know, we've been, you know, writing, you know, SaaS businesses and building startups in the cloud for what, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years? whatever the number you want to use, it's really young compared to, you know, every other field of study that we pursue rigorously as a species, right? And so, what, you know, we haven't learned that much over that time that we know to be absolutely true. We have a lot of hypotheses. We've certainly tried, God knows, we've tried many ways to skin the cat that is, you know, software engineering and organizing teams to do software engineering. I mean, I do think, you know, something that I work really hard on and that I love talking about is, you know, there's a lot of fluff out there. There's a lot of things that probably work in many situations. But what are the things that we really know are universally true about good engineering teams? What do we really know about good software engineering generally? What, when we say, oh, well, high-performing engineering team, what does that mean? Right? And I think we have a couple of ways to think about that. You know, I think some of the work that you know, Linear B does with respect to things that look like cycle time, it seems like we all as an industry agree that this is probably, there's some truth here, right? There truly is something about improving cycle time that is actually higher performance. And that is probably going to be a measure of engineering teams that we all adopt over the next coming decades as true. And there are a couple of other things in there that we figured out, but you know, we're still learning, right? We're still trying to figure that out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really cool that you brought up kind of it's like a great story, by the way, and cool that you brought up learning. How do you feel we're doing as an industry or a community in our pursuit of learning? Do you think it's top of mind for the industry? Do you think, like, you know, I have met some other people out there that maybe say the opposite. Like, I know these a lot of things to be true. This is how you build software development. Do you have a sense of where we stand as a community on that?
I mean, I won't pretend to know all the answers, of course. I do think within a certain context, we know a lot of things that are right and wrong, right? I think, you know, if you want to build a web application, right, you could start from scratch. And most people, myself included, would tell you that's the wrong way to do it. Like, if you're writing vanilla JS, you have to think about so many concerns, right? Accessibility, responsiveness, how, you know, the size of your payload that you're downloading to the page, you know, browser compatibility. Like, you know, if you're a startup, you could solve all those problems, right? But there's many other ways to do it that solve those problems. Just as an example of, you know, what is pretty black and white, right and wrong way to do things nowadays. But that's not universal, right? That's not universal to engineering teams, right? That's a specific problem or in a specific style of product that's being built. Right? What if you're building a mobile app or you're building backend applications or you're building APIs, right? You know, the necessity of using a front-end framework obviously is not a truism if you're building, you know, a backend messaging protocol or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think what is great and inspires me on a daily basis is engineers, broadly speaking, are very hungry to learn and very eager to learn about, you know, what's the latest and greatest. I think the idea of stagnating and using the same tool stack over and over, for the people I've worked with that are the most intellectually hungry, like that's a great way to lose people, right? I think one of the truisms in engineering is if you're going to be hiring creative people, the reason you're hiring them is to exercise that creativity to build software. You have to give them the freedom to experiment and learn and try new things. So if as a manager, you're saying, oh, this is 100% how we do things and no experimentation and you can't trial anything new is allowed, you quickly demotivate people in the workplace with that sort of style.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think from my experience, you know, working with engineers, working with engineering leaders, it's sometimes fun to compare us to other, you know, departments. I think overall, we're fairly humble, in the sense of learning, right? Very complex stuff that we're doing. Combination of architectures, code, not to mention all the people problems, working together as a team. We'll get into it, I think, a little later in the pod. But, you know, for example, I know that you're very big into, well, I want to call it process, but more like efficiency of engineering organizations. Maybe we're even in the infancy there. And you have gotten, so you didn't do the dual major. I don't think you didn't end up doing that, but you did become founder and CTO, which means that I think you have at least somewhat of a good business acumen. How has that kind of like a learning mentality helped you as a CTO?
Yeah, I think there's no handbook or textbook on how to be a CTO, right? Matt Boshry has written a phenomenal book titled, "You're the Great CEO Within," right? If you're going to be a founder of a company, and I don't know Matt, I don't get any money off this. I just think it's a great book. Great CEO Within. This is sort of a guidebook on how to start a company. Right? It goes from everything from financing to hiring people to making business decisions, marketing. Like, it covers the gamut. It's very broad, right? Not super deep, very broad. To breadth-first search and how to be a CEO. I haven't found an equivalent to good book on how to be a CTO, right? And I think there are just as many concerns and different, like, as you're saying, you know, hiring and managing people and architecture and technical decisions and frameworks. There's a lot of table stakes skills that are part of being a CTO. So, you know, to answer your question, how do I do it? I think it really does start with humility. You know, I recognize my training from undergraduate is how to write code, right? And algorithms and optimization and things like that. And yeah, that's helpful in the job of being an engineering leader. And in fact, some of that education is certainly prerequisite. But I think the key thing to acknowledge is, one, the problems you're solving are fairly universal, right? Like as a CTO, every other CTO has similar issues. Hiring people, keeping people happy. How do you organize the team? Thinking about process. So a little bit of humility will say, I'm not the first person to try and solve this kind of problem. And so step one is to recognize, all right, what is the state of the art? How do other people think about this particular problem? And what I found throughout my career is that the combination of independent effort to try and find solutions, usually via books, that's sort of my thing. I'm like huge into audiobooks.
Yeah.
But also just peer groups, working with mentors. Generally, you can talk some of these kinds of problems out and find resources that can help level you up really quickly to sort of ramp up that learning curve. Because there is no textbook to know all of things.
Right. I mean, one thing I'm going to push you to do now is you got to write the book. When you're ready, you're going to write the CTO, how to be a CTO book.
I would love to.
Yeah, I think you can do it. That's I'm marking that down for Zach to do. I'm going to bug you about it maybe once a year.
I have a thing, not related to Dev, but I have on my Google Calendar, my personal Google Calendar, I do make bets with people that are multiple years out. So you set that reminder for 4 years from now and they come up and hold you to it.
Yeah, exactly. You were starting to mention, you know, Audible as, I think, transformational for you in your, you know, adult intelligence. Let's start there. Like, why is Audible so important to you? How did it impact your life?
Yeah. So for starters, I have to give credit to my former co-founder, Lucas Orthwein, who got me into audiobooks. So I personally use Audible. There's many great audio streaming platforms. So I'm just going to say Audible out loud in this story because that's what I use. But, you know, my recommendation to other people is use whatever you like and use great stuff from libraries and so on and so forth. But yeah, I mean, so the way I consume information and, you know, I'm an impatient person and I recognize that, you know, there's strengths, there's good and bad to that as a personality trait, you know, and I try and work on that. But one of the, you know, catering to that, you know, trying to leverage it as a strength, I've picked up speed listening, right? So Audible has a speed slider in the bottom. And so, you know, I regularly listen to nonfiction books between 2 and 3x speed. And so an ordinary business book, generally speaking, 8 to 12 hours of audio content. If you listen to that on 2 or 3x speed, you know, you bring that down to 3 to 5 hours. Now, all of a sudden, that's, you know, that's my car ride for the weekend. You know, if I'm going to take a 2-hour trip to go somewhere, 2 hours there and back, I've got a whole business book done in one weekend. And so, you know, the way I hold myself accountable to that is I have a spreadsheet where I track all the business books I've read. And I take little notes like, what were my key learnings from these? And, you know, which would I like to reread in the future? Things like that. And so, yeah, so the story goes probably 7, 8, 9 years ago, my co-founder Lukens was just listening to audiobooks all the time. And he said, you should really do this too. And I said, I don't have time for that. But, you know, he sort of pushed me on it a little bit and I started doing it. And I'm like, wow, like I'm learning a lot. This is sort of fun. I'm walking, you know, down the street, whatever, you know, I get half an hour in here, half an hour there. You'd be surprised how quickly it becomes a habit, right? And how quickly you find excuses. You know, you're in the middle of a book you're really enjoying. You find an excuse to go for a walk or go for a drive or run on the treadmill, whatever it is. To listen to, you know, whatever that story or whatever that lesson is that's interesting.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask you next. And by the way, I've seen the spreadsheet. Okay, I think we got to get the spreadsheet out to other people. We'll take that, you know, after the show here. Awesome spreadsheet.
Not copyright.
You're ranking all of your books that you've listened to or read in it as well. I saw you have like different categories.
Yeah. So that, it's very personal and subjective. As I said, I'm kind of impatient. And so, you know, fluffier books don't get as good ratings for me.
Yeah. In terms of, you somewhat answered it, but like, are you setting time aside? Are you saying like, okay, I'm a CTO now, or I'm an entrepreneur. I have to be doing this? Or are you just, is it just like when you drive in your car?
So I think the general answer to your question is, as a leader of a team, I have to set aside time for self-improvement in some way, shape, or form, right? Like I need to be constantly picking up signal and learning and looking around the world to see what direction are things going? What are other leaders thinking? What, you know, what's the latest in the blogs? What are the latest in the tools that we're using? So I do set aside time for that generally. Used to be that was, you know, audiobooks all the time. And now it's, you know, audiobooks are generally, you know, in the car when I'm driving places. I don't usually nowadays use the time for that, but I do from time to time. But I am a big believer that, you know, you have to segment your time and find a source that works for you for, you know, learning that sort of stuff.
Do you have like a top three books that you would recommend? You're talking to, you know, an audience on the pod here. I know it's subjective and it's your style, but like your favorite three, I think you've mentioned one that you like.
Yeah. So that's for leaders. I mean, leaders generally, but it's written for CEOs. Tech leaders is sort of like the closest thing to a Bible I found for tech leaders is Managing Humans by Michael Lopp. This guy.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And it's written with sort of a sarcastic humorous bent. And so you have a hope of staying awake through it. It's great.
You can tell by the title, Managing Humans.
Yeah. It's written, you know, for engineers by an engineer. So that's great. Extreme Ownership, I recommend to anybody in any leadership position in any type of organization. It's very, you know, you have to sort of read it with an open mind, right? And especially the audiobook of that is fantastic. The authors are the narrators and they're all, you know, ex-Navy SEALs, Marines, etc. And they've got that, you know, very disciplined, sort of no-nonsense kind of tone to their voice. So when they tell the stories, it really hits home. But yeah, no, so like on Extreme Ownership, I would say, you know, Managing Humans is a good book for you as an individual to read to, you know, hopefully get some insight and perspective as to how to work with an engineering team. Extreme Ownership is if you make an investment as a leader to make it a cornerstone of your company's culture, right? You don't be radical about it. But if everybody in your leadership team reads it, I've done this twice now. And so small sample size, N=2, but still, you know, I've done lots of things with N=2 that haven't worked.
Yeah.
It can be transformational to the way your team communicates, the way people think about problem solving and the way they collaborate in a enormously positive way.
Yeah.
Books of that nature, you know, talk about individual ownership and taking accountability within an organization can be very, very good.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks for sharing that. You know, it's like amazing tips for people listening here, and we'll see if we can get, you know, Zach to publish this list after the show. You and I had lunch the other day. And we were talking about Martin Fowler. I know that you're a big fan of his. I think I had brought up to you, I read his stuff on Ship Show Ask, you know, different ways to handle, you know, pull requests. We got into a conversation about that. But what is it about Fowler? I think you're following his blog. You know, what's going on there? Why is he an idol to you? And what kind of stuff have you been reading?
Yeah, I've never met him. I'd love to one day. So I'll put that out there. Martin, if you're listening, send me an email.
We're going to get you both on the pod. That's the next goal.
That'd be super fun. No, I really appreciate, I think he has a fantastic ability to distill, you know, we were talking about truth earlier, right? Yeah. I think Martin collects a lot of signal, right? He's got a lot of companies or projects that he's seen, and he's got a fantastic way of distilling that into what, you know, what is the truth here in the data that he sees? And make that applicable to other engineering teams. Now, I don't agree with every single thing he's ever published, but broadly speaking, you know, I think he's well known in the community as, you know, somebody who produces these insights. You know, Ship Show Ask is a great example of a framework. He's also very, you know, generous with the spotlight. He's got, you know, guest authors on his blog that also have very insightful things to write about. You know, one of my favorite articles on there is actually about feature toggles. It was written by a guest author, Pete's. Oh, I'm doing him a disservice by not remembering his last name right now. But if you look at Martin Fowler's blog about feature toggles, there's a guest article by a guy named Pete, insert last name here, which is fantastic. And I've shared that cross-functionally and it's had a big impact on teams I've worked. So I think there's that, you know, I love this idea of, you know, the froth that is how do we do engineering, finding the truth and distilling, you know, how should we do work out of all of the noise that's out there. Fowler is exceptional at that and definitely a role model of mine.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's like some of the topics, obviously, we talk on this pod a lot and you and I talk about a lot, you know, going back to do we really know anything or like we haven't been doing this very long, like the whole concept around how we should do work, how does work get done in an engineering organization? We're going to get into that a bit, but I think that's a area usually when I'm like reading something that Fowler did, it's around that type of stuff, like how to get shit done on an engineering team. I think he kind of shines there.
Yeah, absolutely.
The last note I have in this area, you mentioned, is it the Go-To conferences?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so again, no affiliation. I just think they're great.
Yeah.
They're a video, it's a video channel. It's a channel on YouTube. call it Go-To conferences as opposed to the other kinds of channels that might be on YouTube. Yeah, they publish content ranging from, I think it's like 10, 15 minutes up to like hour long talks. And, you know, Fowler's got a handful on there, but there's tons of other good stuff from there as well from, you know, various companies. I think Google's got a handful of talks on there. And it's, you know, smart people going through topics. Many of them are organization related. Many of them are specific technology related. You know, the good news, just like any other YouTube channel, you can pick and choose what's interesting to you. But I make a point of trying to watch one a week or so. Just something that, you know, maybe I know a bit about and I want to learn more, or something I never heard of before. Just a good way to keep up. And again, you know, since it's YouTube, you've got the opportunity, 1.5, 2x speed, you know, get through it at a pace that makes sense.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks for sharing all of these different things, you know, finding truths or exploring the truth, gaining knowledge. If you, you know, you want to be a CTO, you want to be an entrepreneur like Zach, like this is why we're talking about. This is kind of the stuff that, you know, I'd love to see everyone bake into their day-to-day lives or think about it as like a professional, you know, career building. But let's switch a little bit here and now try to get a little more tangible. You have Sure. this knowledge. You've learned things from Martin Fowler. You are the CTO of Dama. Before that, you were working at a company called Growflow, really cool, cool company. But if we were getting more concrete, we can stay with Fowler. I have a few other topics, but like, what is something that you've learned, you know, from him that you've applied tangibly to being a CTO?
That's a great question. I mean, you mentioned Ship Show Ask earlier. Since we already brought it up, let's go through that. So I think, you know, one of the things we don't really know is how do we review code before it goes out? You know, yeah. For anybody who's listening, who's ever gone through a SOC 2 process or similar compliance frameworks, you know, the frameworks say, you know, hard and fast rule, code has to be reviewed by such and such and such in order to go out. You know, a human yep. has to look at this. You know, I can't tell you how many pull requests I've seen where even though a human looked at it, bugs made it out, right? And so just because a human looked at it doesn't make it perfect, right? The idea of perfectly reviewing code before it goes out is really a challenge. And so we need to ask ourselves, you know, why do we do this, right? Obviously, there's value, but, you know, broadly speaking, we see the value, but we don't really talk about the cost. And just like anything else that has both cost and value, we should think about when does it make sense to apply? When does it make sense to seek that value given the cost? And to be very explicit, the cost of a pull request is actually, in my view, pretty high. Right? You have a developer who's working on a thing. They have to stop working on the thing, create the pull request, interrupt another developer, either in the moment or, you know, whenever that developer gets around to it. And then in which case, whoever started it now has to context switch and go do something else. They get feedback, then they have to context switch back, adjust the feedback. And now we have this sort of asynchronous or maybe even synchronous time sync on a pull request. And that, you know, there's value there, but it's also expensive. And so can we think about and be mindful and deliberate about when do we use that tool as a way to improve quality? You know, if somebody's just updating a typo, does that really need to interrupt another developer to fix a typo in some copy? Are we adjusting some CSS colors? You know, we can come up with a list of 1,000 different categories of things that are trivial changes that, since we trust our developers because they're smart people and we've interviewed them and we've made them jump through all sorts of hoops to join our team, right, we should presumably trust them to do, you know, fairly low risk things. And so creating that taxonomy to describe the risk of a pull request and then, you know, applying the expensive tools to the high risk scenarios to do our best to de-risk sort of seems to make intuitive sense to me, right? And that's sort of this idea of ship, show, ask that Fowler's getting at.
Yeah, I mean, that's something like this is what you and I talked about over lunch, something that I'm starting to study now. Some of the things that we're doing from like a feature perspective at Linear B is kind of categorizing change of work, like branches, different categories of risk, which ones, you know, maybe can go through what we all kind of, or at least I grew up with like the standard PR process, but some of them can be, you know, merged automatically. Other ones, you know, I have talked to a lot of customers. Let's say that there is, you know, a situation of a really, really large change. Some of them need multiple reviewers. But I think the problem in the industry in this area right now is like we're treating everything exactly the same. Yes. And it's not.
If you go to GitHub or Bitbucket or GitLab and you look at the settings for, you know, the rules that you enforce on pipelines, it's binary.
Yeah.
Right. Every PR needs a reviewer or none. Right. It's just a checkbox. Yeah. There's no nuance to it.
Yeah. Have you been able to do anything? I know it's like a very new like concept, and we just started talking about it again. Like in Linear B, we're just releasing the feature right now that says, "Hey, this is a really low risk PR. We're sending it over in Slack. We're sending a code snippet and saying, could you just review this right now and push approve?" That's like one example, because you know the average. I have like some data on my mind. Jonathan, our producer, I just did like a podcast like with him. The average time of a pull request, like you know, I think we studied about a million PRs is 4 days and 10 hours to get a review done. That's the average. Even the ones that are just looks good to me, like LGTM, still 4 days. And because you got to find, like you're saying, find someone, pick it up. Is there anything, and this will, this relates to like speed and, you know, some of your thoughts on, you know, efficient engineering teams, but is there anything that you've been able to do to kind of like either improve the efficiency or treat different code differently? I know you're into trunk-based development. Like, what is your stance on all this stuff?
Yeah. So, you know, admittedly, we're at Domo, we're still pretty unsophisticated about how we think about this problem. It's a conversation I've been having with our dev leads about, you know, how do we want to implement this? What do we think makes the most sense for us? What we've, you know, some things that have occurred somewhat organically, as we are, and I'm not espousing this, that, you know, there's pros and cons, but we are a many repo shop. So we've got, I don't know, 50, 100 different repositories for various things. And so when somebody makes a new service or a new repository, generally speaking, the review is very light, right? It's the only expert in that service is the person who just started it, right? And so the review is much more high level at that point. You know, we do a spec review on it, but that initial version, which has no consequences to be released because it's an unused MVP, right? We sort of trust the person who's built that repository to do that initial version. And once we have something that's stable, we want to maintain that stability. Now there's risk, right? When it's a brand new and it's the first thing and nobody's ever seen it before, the only real risk is directional, right? It's like, are we building something in the direction we want to go? Are we using the right tools? It's not so much that, you know, they're going to introduce a lot of code and a null pointer exception is going to take something down for customers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's brand new. So that's something that, you know, for sure is institutionalized. And that sort of harkens back to the, like, you know, day one startup thing. Like, if you're just an independent contributor at day one at your company, like, of course, like, nobody's reviewing it, but you're just writing it.
Right.
It's on you. And so we want to sort of, you know, that's what is thought of, I think, in the collective headspace as like the ultimate in fast. It's just the single engineer working on their own project. And so you want to get as close to that where you can. And I think that's, this one mechanism sort of approaches that. Beyond that, like that, you know, we're still pretty unsophisticated. You know, pretty much everything else still requires, you know, code review, especially, you know, a lot of our business is banking. And so we need to be very, very mindful of the risks there and very thoughtful. And of course, compliance regime, so on and so forth. You've got to check all the right boxes.
Yeah. It's like another example of where you could argue that the art, you know, in terms of like all of human lifetime, we're in our infancy in this area. I think Fowler brought up like a lot of good points and, you know, we're getting there. One thing that you said, so I'll, you know, kind of quote you here. You've said speed is a proxy for a high performing engineering team or teams. And I think you mentioned to me, like, maybe, I don't know if this is at Dama or Growflow or whatever, but you said like you were in like a multi-week or even a monthly cadence, you know, for shipping. And now you're down to like daily, maybe for merging. What was that journey like? And like, how do you think about speed and performance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you talk to any business leader ever, they always want to move faster, right? So let's take that as a premise, right? We want speed.
But I think that's a truth. That's a truth.
There you go. Every business
wants you to move fast.
Yes, the business wants you to do it faster and for less.
Yeah, do it faster.
And with half as many people and a tenth the budget.
That's the only thing now I know the only truth in engineering. The only truth in engineering is that the business wants you to do it faster. It is kind of true.
100% agree on that. I'm sure there's a blog post in there on that topic.
Yeah.
No, I think the meat and potatoes and what is speed for engineering teams, you know, is let me actually start with my experience, right? So ground this in what I've seen in the real world. When you have, there's two major pieces to it. One is how often do you ship code? And the second is how often do you ship features, right? And I think for most teams that haven't really invested in things that look like feature toggles and feature flags, those two things are the same, right? When you ship the code is when the feature goes out. That necessarily sometimes has complications and complexity. You know, your new feature is maybe only designed to be used by some customers, or the new feature needs to be coordinated with the marketing effort, or a documentation needs to be written for that feature before it goes out. And so that might delay the release of the features. Now, engineering is holding this branch open, right, for some other department to finish whatever else it is they need to do. You know, and of course, everybody in the audience here probably understands if you've got that stale branch, you've got, you know, the developers forgetting about it, it's a more expensive context switch, opportunity for conflicts, all kinds of bad things have code that's not finished, right? We could probably have a whole separate podcast discussing that topic.
Yeah, it gets stale. Only bad things can happen.
Yeah, only bad things happen with especially large stale branches. So that's the first thing, right? Just divorcing the idea of shipping code and shipping features. In my experience, I have led teams through a transition of multi-week deployments to daily deployments at least two or three times. The difference in the amount of overhead as an engineering team, now this is beyond the divorcing from features, this is just shipping code, is tremendous. You know, let me paint a picture of what it looks like to, just for the sake of conversation, of what does it look like to ship code once every 2 weeks? Well, you choose your release date, which presumably is either a meeting or maybe you're lucky and it's just a thing you do on calendar, but be mindful of things that look like holidays or people being on days off. So there's, you know, all sorts of exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to figure out what's going to go in there. Now, the individual developer who's working on a feature, they want to get their feature in before whatever the cutoff is. And so there's a mad scramble before whatever the cutoff is to get your stuff in. Maybe that means working late. Maybe it means high stress, whatever it is. And okay, inevitably something was missed. And now the business doesn't want to wait 2 weeks. So now you have this sort of hot fix, you know, routine that you're going through to inject these extra things in between.
Yeah.
And you have to do, you know, larger feature releases. And it's much riskier. You've got all this code built up over your 2 weeks or whatever your interval is that goes out. The chances of having a problem are much, much higher. And there's just more stuff. It's harder to review all of that change. Now, once you move to more frequent releases, all of these problems literally disappear, right? There's no more scheduling when the release is. The release is just tomorrow, where it's when you merge the code, right? Ideally. There's no more worried about, I got to get my feature in before the cutoff, because the feature goes in when the feature goes in and it goes out the next day. The code goes in whenever it goes in, right? You don't have to worry about it being merged. Your actual on-disk branching gets dramatically simpler. You know, if I'm working on a feature that takes, let's say, 4 weeks, but my release cycle is 2 weeks, I'm maintaining my feature branch for potentially 4 weeks and missing all of this stuff where I have to rebase all the time and these huge amounts of changes. Now, we could talk again, long-lived branches themselves, you know, whether they get merged or not, how quickly they get merged aside, long-lived branches have their own sets of problems.
So, for sure.
The real world, migrating teams and migrating process, and I don't want to make it sound like it's, you know, it's all tulips and rainbows. There's definitely work that has to be put in, hard work that has to be put in to prep a team from a process perspective and a technology perspective to do that transition, but it is 1,000,000% payoff, right? That is a journey I would go down with any team and say that the ROI is absolutely there. Transformative even, and just how work gets done and then how quickly things can go up.
And have you done that transformation? Have you gotten through a full, okay, let's say that we're, I don't know, we'll go extreme, like we're releasing once a month, just code, we're getting code out. Have you gone from once a month to daily or something like that?
Yeah, so Growflow ships two main applications, the Growflow retail side and the Growflow wholesale side. They're primarily different code bases. The wholesale code is hosted on Windows containers. It was hosted on Windows machines with IIS and released some number of weeks, right? Sometimes every 2 weeks, sometimes every 3 weeks. Today, it's hosted on Windows containers and Kubernetes with a full CI/CD pipeline and gets deployed every morning, right? So we've gone through that transition, which was not only the process of let's rethink, you know, how we merge code, but also we need to totally rethink how code is deployed. It used to take, you know, one or two developers had the special expertise on how to do a release, and it would take hours in the morning. You know, various configurations had to be updated. There was a manual blue-green deploy setup that had to be configured and updated every time we did a release. All of that had to be automated, right? And so we made that investment to do the automation. And now a release, somebody just pushes a button and it just goes out. Or it's just done on a schedule and you don't even think about it. You merge the code the day before, you just trust that by, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning the next day, it's all just out there. I mean, if anything catastrophic happened, it was automatically rolled back or people knew about it, so on and so forth. So yeah, it's absolutely a doable thing. I've done it a number of times in a number of teams and highly recommend it.
Absolutely. I know you're like a huge, huge, huge proponent of this. Probably a lot of people listening to the pod are saying to themselves, I really want to do this. Is there any tips that you can give either from like the technology side or the people side or the growing pains? A takeaway for someone listening that wants to get into that daily, you know, shipping of code, but maybe they're saying to themselves, it seems so far away, or I don't know if it's worth it. Like, what are the tips?
I empathize for starters, right? I've been in those shoes and I've had conversations with engineers where I'm all gung ho about it, but there's a lot of trepidation because the difference between here and there can be substantial.
Yeah.
It can take time. So, you know, tips are, for starters, I'm a big believer in the general ethos of if it hurts, do it more, right? Things that are painful for the organization, the only way to make it less painful is to do it more and automate, right? You know, as I was just talking about, releasing used to take hours and be high risk, and now it's basically free. So tips for the organization, you know, I think talking about as a culture internally within your engineering team about the idea of if it hurts, we need to do it more. Let's lean into the things that are difficult for us so that they become easy. That concept, I think, is very, very powerful And I encourage, you know, other engineering leaders that aren't already thinking about it to think about that. The other thing I would really strongly think about and consider is time horizons. This transformation does not have to happen in a week, right? This could be a 12-month process.
I don't think it can happen in a week for most. You know, it's like not even feasible.
Yeah. So this is, you know, this is your horizon two, horizon three, your mid long-term strategy to get there. You know, for us, you know, the prerequisites, a lot of technical prerequisites even before we change the process. And so there's a roadmap, you know, in this quarter, we're going to tackle these tech prerequisites and next quarter, we're going to do these. You know, our culture and process specifically set a time for what we call innovation sprints, where we have, you know, a little bit more freedom from the roadmap to make these kinds of investments. Now, if your organization doesn't necessarily have that and you're, you know, strictly sprint to sprint to sprint, then you need to argue with the stakeholders that make that prioritization that these sorts of investments will unlock productivity and velocity down.
Yeah.
And that is a very, you know, feel free to call me as a witness to that ROI. But yeah, think about it as a medium or a long-term initiative. You know, if you go to your engineering manager or to your team and say, we're going to do this week, you know, I think everybody's just going to be overwhelmed with the size of that task. It's not a doable thing, as you said.
Yeah.
In most cases. But over 12
months. Yeah, you'll get a ton of pushback. I mean, you got to, I think what's probably hard is I'm wondering if when you're doing this change, do you have engineers coming to you? Like, what do they say? Like, do some say, we can't do this? Or do others say, we can totally do this? Or like, what is the range that you're getting?
I think the number one anxiety is we're going to break it everywhere, right? That, you know, we're going to ship stuff that isn't well tested enough. Or we have this extensive QA flow that there's no time to do that QA flow. Right? And I think the answer to that is you need to rethink a couple of things about how quality assurance is done. You know, I'm a big proponent. If you're going to be doing daily releases, you probably want feature branch environments to test individual features separate from the main code base. That way, you know, everybody has a really clean, easy, predictable way to test something as close to production as possible without being production. So you can have that confidence that when it's merged, things will go well.
Yeah.
And that requires, again, more DevOps investment to make, you know, something like that a reality. But there's a lot of tools nowadays that make it a lot easier. So the other thing I would say is when you move to something that looks like more continuous deployment, there will be pain, right? There will be a couple of mornings where at 8 o'clock in the morning, the code goes out and there's a new bug and there has to be an emergency rollback.
Right? Yeah.
And so making sure those procedures are in place, that you know about those kinds of problems, you can roll back in, you know, a couple of minutes. Generally speaking, a couple of oops here and there is not ending for the business and is reasonable taxed. I don't want to speak for everybody's business. In many cases, that might not be okay. But in most cases, you know, a bug that goes out for an hour is not the end of the world. But the team gets better at it. Right? These kinds of things do go down over time. You know, the product I was talking about earlier that moved to, you know, from weekly to continuous deployment, I don't think we've ever had a release where, you know, major issues happen that we need to do a dramatic rollback. Certainly not, maybe one or two in the first couple of weeks. But since then, it's been okay. And you'd be surprised how if you're making small changes and you're following general best practices, these kind of, and of course, you're writing tests and, you know, you're doing all the other healthy, responsible things in the code base, teams do get better at it and it does tend to work out.
Yeah.
And if it's not, then, you know, you got to revisit some of those ones.
We probably need to do a whole pod just on this one topic, the transformation that you went through there. You brought up innovation sprints, I think you called them. Is that related? I have a note here around the shape up model. Do these two go hand in hand or?
They do.
What's up with the shape up model?
So shape up is, I believe it's Basecamp that published an ebook. Let me make sure I'm quoting that. Yes, it is from Basecamp. They published an ebook about how they do work, right? And this is in the vein of Agile's Kanban Scrums. And the model that's proposed is a 6-2 framework. You have 6-week sprint or a 6-week cycle, followed by 2 weeks of, I think, what ShapeUp calls a cool down period. And so, you know, you're focusing on your features and your roadmap for 6 weeks, and then you've got 2 weeks to tie up loose ends, make sure it's bug free, make investments, you know, work on some of these systematic issues that, you know, so we've been discussing today. And we've used that model for a couple of years now. And I think broadly speaking, it's been very successful. You know, the reason I call it an innovation sprint is within engineering, everybody knows what cooldown means. But outside of engineering, they hear the word cooldown and they go, oh, engineers are sipping pina coladas. They're on the beach.
Yeah.
Even though that's not the case. So we've rebranded it to an innovation sprint to avoid that issue.
Yeah.
It's having that dedicated, you know, Google used to do 20% time. So, you know, I think the modern incarnation of Google is slightly different, but the general idea of explicitly making space where trials, experimentation, debt is very healthy and really does contribute over the medium and long term to much increased velocity and also just developer happiness. Like, tech debt not only slows down your product, like, it's just miserable for as a developer. And like, every time you have to deal with whatever that problem is, you know, it's taxing to your productivity and your morale.
Is this a defining piece of the culture for you, for your engineering organizations, like the concept of making space for the cool down period? Or how does that impact culture for you?
Yeah, I think in this case, this implementation is, the idea is cornerstone. That the individual developer, maybe not every day, but there is a process and a space for, you know, hey guys, we're using version 12 of React and they're on 18 now and there's all of this stuff in between. And it's going to take me a couple of days to do that upgrade. When and where and how can I do that? Right? Like, that has to be systematized. It can't just be one-offs, because there's, you know, hundreds of these kinds of conversations that need to happen and kinds of projects that people want to do. And over time, you'll suffer. Right? If you're still on React 12 in 2028, that's obviously a problem. You know, there needs to be a path to, you know, deal with that kind of debt. And I think that the key thing is people need to feel safe making these proposals and know that they will be considered fairly by the team. Myself, the way these things are done, innovation sprints are fairly relaxed. We call it choose your own adventure. Sometimes it's choose your own adventure from this list of adventures. Like, we'll have identified the top 20 areas of tech debt that we think are interesting or valuable up front. Sometimes it's completely open. We also have an internal RFC process, right? RFC, request for comment. And so if there's something about the way we do business as engineering that can be improved, we ask people there's a formal process where you can write a document, literally an RFC following an RFC template, and then it's reviewed. There's a comment period, and then ultimately there's a vote and an approval. And so we have RFCs for things like, how do we do feature toggles? We have RFCs for our language, right? We don't use the phrases whitelist and blacklist. We use allow list and deny list, right? And that is codified as an RFC. And so everywhere we do that, everybody knows this is just how we talk about these kinds of things, you know, day-to-day process. And I think the magic of the RFC process is, it's not like there's that many of them, is that it really is democratic. It's not coming from me as the CTO. Anybody can make an RFC at any time and get some comments and start a healthy discussion about how do we want to do whatever the thing is that we're talking about. And so I think this, all of this circles around the idea of people need to feel safe to introduce these ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I love your leadership style. I mean, you're kind of, you blend together this concept of let's bake in things that allows developers, give them space to reduce technical debt, maybe redo something that, you know, wasn't done in the most optimal way. It's actually baked into the way that you work. And you're also then combining that with, and I don't know if it's fully come out in the pod, like, I think an obsession. This is why, you know, not only you're a Linear B customer, but we kind of, you know, hit it off, an obsession with speed to delivery and doing it in a high quality way, getting down to those daily releases. How has that impacted the business? Or like, how is you as a CTO, do you go back to the business and say, like, this is the impact now of the way that we work?
Yeah. I'll tell a short story to answer that question.
Yeah.
So 2021, last year, if you're not familiar, so Growflow is in the cannabis space. You know, all of our customers are cannabis retailers, wholesalers, etc. April 20th, which 420, joke. Yeah, it's a big day in the cannabis world.
Yeah.
At, I think, like 8:45 in the morning in Pacific time, just as the majority of our customers are about to open their doors for the day, one of our critical dependencies went down. Auth0 went down on 420 last year. Auth0 is a login and user credentialing provider, which meant none of our cashiers or budtenders could log in, right? So they couldn't log into a platform to start transacting business.
And I'm sure they have a lot of sales going on that day, promotional material.
Yeah, out the door, perhaps, of angry customers who, you know, get in and take advantage. So not good, right? You know, pants on fire kind of moment, drop everything. So we, thankfully, Auth0 is not, we have, let's just say we have backup plans in place for, you know, what happens, or how do we handle users in the event that we can't get the information we need from Auth0. However, it's not something that we'd exercised, right? So it required a code change. We had to do a release in order to actually remove that dependency so people could log in and use the application in a slightly degraded but still functional state. So it took us about 15 minutes, maybe 10 minutes to figure out, you know, what the change is that was needed. And because we have this process in place where it's super easy to deploy code to production, you know, we have thousands of customers using this platform, and so it's a fairly wide deployment. Make the code change, ship it, merge it to the right branch, and then you sit in your hands for about the next 6 minutes while the code goes out, right? And so, you know, within about half an hour, we had diagnosed the problem, made the code change, and got it to all of our production customers so people could log in on this critical morning of 4/20.
Nice.
Now, there were other businesses that I will not name that were impacted by this, which were down for better part of the whole day.
Yeah.
And I don't know the details of, you know, what actually went on behind the scenes there. But I would say in our case, the flexibility to do that kind of deploy and just have all of that be automated in 6 minutes gave us a huge competitive leg up in that.
Yeah, that's awesome. You know, we talk about cycle time a lot on this pod and using that metric as an indicator of team health and performance. But I think what's like another way to look at it is what, you know, if I said to you, Zach, I want to make a change and it can be the smallest change possible. How fast can you get it out? We're talking about mean time to restore now. Just because you can go and diagnose a problem, you know what the issue is, maybe, it doesn't mean that you can have that amazing turnaround time. You have to have, you know, and of course that will impact your cycle time. You have to have the technical side in place, the people side in place to get a change out in, I think you said 15 minutes or less, something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's incredible. Awesome.
But on top of all the benefits of, you know, the company asks, when's this feature going to be released? And you say, the minute the developer's done and it's past QA, right? As opposed to, oh, it's going to have to wait 2 weeks for that cycle.
Yeah, usually, you know, oftentimes you get a huge, you're like fumbling for words. I've been in this situation, like, okay, when's it going to be delivered? Well, we're finished developing the thing like on, you know, this coming Friday. And the CEO will be like, okay, so it's done? No, it's not done, because then we actually have to like do this bill, but then we have some other stuff that needs to get in. And then you're like a few more weeks and they're like saying like, when is the customer going to have it? Right? It's not a fun situation to be in, but
yeah,
you know.
Absolutely. I think I do, you know, I should acknowledge that, you know, sprints and bi-week releases can maybe give you a bit more predictability on when things will go out. But I would actually argue that, you know, by gaining that predictability that it'll be out in 2 weeks, you're actually losing the opportunity of releasing it potentially even sooner with maybe a little bit of uncertainty, right? So the developer finishes it the minute that it passes whatever the testing is, as opposed to it going out 7 days later with the scheduled release. Well, you've just bought 7 days. Case.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very cool stuff. The last topic that we have here, you know, there's a few things around architecture that I think you wanted to express. You said it's imperative that, you know, your people, your staff, or your engineers are fluent in your architecture. And that's maybe a truth that you've learned. Can you tell us why?
Yeah. I think the concept here revolves around, I think, what the industry refers to as the distributed monolith, right? And just for the sake of explanation, you know, generally speaking, you have your monolith, which is your single code base, right? Everything is sort of tied together in memory. And you have your perfect microservice world, which we all live in, right? Exactly. Where you have thousands of services that are very small with, you know, no explicit dependencies outside of the contracts between them. Now, ideally, you want to be in one of those two scenarios. The middle ground is you have the distributed monolith, which is you have multiple services, but they're actually fairly tightly tied together. And the way the test to know whether they're too tightly tied together is, are they 100% independently deployable? Right. Or is there, you know, in order to deploy this service, this other service has to be updated first. Now, that's basically the worst possible scenario because you're not getting the benefits of basically independent deployability that you get in microservices. And you still have sort of the tight coupling from the model. And so when I say your development team needs to understand the architecture, they need to understand enough to A, avoid that scenario. Right? They need to know, okay, we're either in a monolith and this is our pattern and how we make that maintainable, which is a totally doable thing as long as we're intentional about it. Or we're, you know, a microservice or many-serviced SOA, service-oriented architecture, and this is how we define our contracts, right? This is our business process for how we make changes to those contracts. This is how we think about the data domains. And if you need to move data between services, you know, this is sort of our standard way of doing that. Now, the mistake or the problem comes if you're not, there is no process for that, and you just let anybody make any change, then it's very easy for those dependencies to accidentally creep in, right? And so having a mechanism in place to avoid accidental dependencies between services is actually pretty important to avoid ending up in that distributed monolith.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying everybody has to be an expert in everything, right? But understanding, how does my business do contracts, right? And what is the protocol? Are you using RPCs or protobufs or GraphQL or whatever it is, PubSub? When you have developers that need to interface with those services, those things should be easy. Right? I'm a big believer in you want to make the desired behavior of the team the default, right? And the default is what's the easy thing? How has it been done before? Right? If the easiest thing to do is actually the right answer, that's cohesive with the architecture, well, that's the place you want to be. If the right thing to do is actually really hard and takes a lot of work, then people probably aren't going to do that. And so you want to make the investment in, you know, putting a process in place and whatever tools or documentation is required, so people understand how the contracts are written, they understand how to make a change, and the tooling is in place to extend, augment, update these things so that people don't have to reinvent the wheel every time they go about it.
Is there anything that you have done or are doing to ensure that fluency for your people?
So the tool stack that we've chosen, and this is an opinionated thing, there's many right answers to this problem, but the answer that we've settled on is we have an Apollo Superbrew. Right, so we've invested internally very heavily in GraphQL. And everybody knows, you know, if you want to make an internal call to another internal service, there's the single graph where you can literally go read the schema at any time and make a query or mutation against that graph, and some service will answer it and figure out, you know, how to deal with your query. And so that's pretty ubiquitous at this point. And so everybody knows, you know, what that endpoint is, how to get to that schema. And Apollo, you know, to their credit, actually has some really great tools that make managing that graph fit into development workflow. So if you're going to, for example, publish a change to the contract that's going to break a query that gets run on a regular basis, they have that information. They have a, you know, got tracing so you can see exactly what queries are run. So if you're going to, you know, change the method signature of one of these queries, something from a string to an integer, for example, it'll say, hey, wait, that's actually going to break these six clients. And it's going to tell you that in your CI/CD pipeline. So before it even gets to test, the developer gets that feedback. And oh, by the way, you need to handle this better. Right? Either don't update that contract or make the change to backwards compatible way, or, you know, worst case, you know, update the dependencies. And so I think we've chosen an ecosystem that gives us tools to make these things obvious and help developers do good work. There will, you know, I'm not saying it's the best. There are others that are good as well, but this one has worked out for us.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, Zach, we've covered so many topics on here. I think we could probably do like five more podcasts just on each topic. And of course, you know,
you
I think
find
we
me
will
lunch, I'll
do
keep
that.
Coming back, Dan.
Yeah, we'll have you back. And yeah, so thank you so much for coming on the Dev Interrupted podcast today. We look forward to your book on how to be a CTO or something along those lines.
CTO's handbook.
And yeah, thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you, Dan. No, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much.
Everything that we have talked about today will be available in the description below, including Zach's spreadsheet of his ranked audiobooks. And as I'm reading this recording, Zach is writing, "Don't give me write access to the script," as he's inserting more promotional things here. Zach, again, thank you so much for joining the show today.
Thank you so much, man.